This is Two Dope Boys and a podcast. I'm Michael Brooks.
I'm Phil McKenzie.
Two Dope Boys is a shout out from the margins. Each week we break down trends using the lens of culture to shed light on what's significant to your future and why. How you doing, man?
Doing pretty good.
Yo, this has been a hectic. We've got not gonna drag him, but there is a member of crew who didn't show up last minute. You might associate him with the sports world.
Subtle.
Yeah, real subtle. He needs to be at least subtly dragged. We missed last week's show because we had a snowstorm. I mean, things have been crazy.
Yeah,
things have been a little off kilter.
It's been hectic, but I feel good being back among familiar faces, familiar environments. And, you know, for all those.
The team is reassembling.
Yeah, for all those sports related folks out there. I always say home games.
Home games. Home games better than away games.
Everybody will know what that means. Yep. Those who know will know. Learn to play home games.
Learn to play home games. And I used to resist you on that, and now I'm entirely team home game.
Yeah, man. I built my life on home games.
Down to the Poland Springs bottle waiting in the fridge. little care package.
Yeah, man. Let's learn from one of the all-time greats, Derek Jeter.
Yeah, yeah.
Jeets, man. He used to give him a whole...
I know.
Takeaway.
Yeah, I know.
Gift basket at the end of the night.
Gift basket.
But very effective.
Very effective. I might be out of the racket. But at any rate, we got to get to the other brand F-up of the week. Yeah. Phil, what it is.
This brand F up just is this the gift that keeps on giving with this particular person, and we're talking about everyone's favorite favorite tragic mulatto, Sage Steele.
Damn, she's made it like this is the second time in literally a month.
Yeah, and you know what? There'll probably be another time. March ain't over.
Yeah,
you know, there's still time for Sage Steele to give us one of her perfect sunken place. You know, shout outs. And about a week and a half ago, you know, so this is coming a little late because of all the snowstorm and all the rest of the stuff. But like I said, it's evergreen when it comes to Sage. She got upset at one of the players from the Warriors, Andre Iguodala, who used the N-word during a press conference. Mm-hmm. And to her outrage, he used it more than once. And as she tweeted, you know, he dropped the N-word three times in this press conference. And then her, at the time, Michael Wilbon, who was co-hosting the show with her, was like, meh. He kind of gave her the, who cares about this, you know? And so again, Sage Steele finds a way to critique, criticize, to, you know, point the mulatto finger at black people. So what do we think about this?
I mean, I just thought it was interesting that I mean, she went with the kind of angle of like this whole like trope around there's a double standard with using the word, which is unfair. And I just, speaking as a white person,
no,
you know, I know a lot of people, shocks a lot of people. I'm more Minister Farrakhan than you, Phil. So, but I mean, I have just never. I don't even understand, and I don't think it requires any level of sophistication or wokeness or whatever the fuck word you want to use to both understand why maybe using that word is different as a white person. And by the way, like, I'm not even one of those people who's like, I will never use the word. Like, if it's in a quote, I'll read the quote.
Yeah.
I've had comedy routines where, yep, that word will, like, I don't even hold it like, that word will never come out of my mouth. But the basic premise that you can't understand that as a white person, that word means something entirely different coming out of your mouth, pretty much no matter the context. And that number two, like, I have managed to, you know, in my time on this earth, you know, accomplish fair amount of things, have some interesting experiences, you know, travel to parts of the world, have a pretty productive life without using that word. I have not found that it's held me back.
So it is possible to do.
Yeah, I just The fact that she would go, because when you first sent it to me, I thought the angle was, just from the headline, I was like, okay, that's funny because this is the same moron that was, you know, criticizing people protesting to protect constitutional rights and against the Muslim ban, and now, and has said a bunch of kind of weird racial stuff, and now all of a sudden she's going to come out with the, like, you know, this is, we can't, you know, this is just, you know, kind of like a respectability politics. But instead, she kind of veered left with this whole, like, double standard, white people can't say a thing. And it just starts to lead me to think that, like, I don't know what happened to this woman. I don't know if she's been abducted by Scientologists. I don't know. But she's out of her mind.
I mean, it's an odd argument to make, because I think everyone understands that, or everyone should understand that there are clearly things within any particular group that members of that group can say and do, allude to, talk about, understand, that other people in that group that are not in that group can't.
Right.
You know, it's just the way it is. Like, I mean, I've heard...
It's the same thing with families.
Yeah, I've heard any number of you can name the ethnic group that they will use things and say words and terms, even that are not necessarily, like, derogatory, they're kind of inside, that I would never use. You know, it's just like I could hear them saying it and talking about it, and I would be like, okay, that's cool that y'all rock like that, but I'm not going to be around other people of your group and then use the same terminology. And that goes for ethnicities, whether you're Latino or Jewish and things like that, or even like gender.
Right.
Like, I've heard, you know, many women among their friends, you know, or people they know really well, use the same terms that, like, are completely anti-women and destructive and whatever the list of them are,
right,
that they will that I would never use with, like, a group of women, even that are my friends.
Yeah. But I mean, I guess what's the play here? Like, is this is a brand F up from our perspective, but for her, is she just really sinking straight into that zone? You know, she's appealing to a certain audience.
Yeah, I mean, she's auditioning sports, for Fox.
Like, she's auditioning for Fox. She wants to play that role on The Five or whatever. And sports, as we say all the time, is one of the last kind of, like, relatively unitary experiences in kind of, like, mass media and culture. Though, obviously, I think there's, you know, very different, you know, the politics around the NBA are very different than the politics around the NFL. But that being said, you know, if you're doing sports, that's probably one of the only mediums that's left where you will probably be, in some rough sense, just as likely to encounter an audience member that's a, you know, that's a Trump person as a Bernie person. Everybody watches sports.
Yeah.
So, you know, I guess she's hitting an angle in it.
Yeah, I get her type.
But it's embarrassing.
But she's going for that. I mean,
yeah.
Sage Steele could be of like a paper, dissertation on all the, like, fuck shit going on in that chick's head. But, you know, from family and all this, like, military father background, that was the last bullshit she was involved in. Like, I get it. She's one of these, like, I wear literally the flag lapel on my sleeve, in like, mixed metaphor there, but, like, all of that is so important.
Right.
And I'm going to be the ultimate expression of my inclusion in America is going to be patriotism and all nonsense. So I see her and see through her, and she's a cornball.
Do you think she actually voted for Trump?
Yeah.
Wow. All right. Well, there's no greater brand F up than that. Now we got to go to What's Up.
Now we want to jump into What's Up, and this comes from the world of advertising and creativity, and I use those words lightly in this instance.
And in general.
Yeah, this is a pretty interesting story, I think, actually, because it gives us an opportunity to talk about a couple of things. So I'll just set it up very briefly, and then we can kind of go back and forth on it. Creative agency David, which reps Heineken. Where did that come from? Which reps Heinz, famous for many products, but most famous for ketchup, obviously, made the news just this past week, where what they did was basically repurpose famous creative on advertising from the fictional show Mad Men. So obviously, we all, those who are fans of Mad Men and remember the show, Don Draper was the creative director and genius of many of their advertising.
Great
and,
guy.
And came up with a pitch for Heinz, which would show three iconic types of foods that one would think of that would go really well with ketchup, but wouldn't show any ketchup at all. It would just show the food with a very simple tagline. So just to kind of read a little bit from this article, creative agency David is taking only some of the credit for its newest Heinz campaign, which includes three New York billboards and ads in two print publications. The ads are nearly identical recreations of ads Mr. Draper, played by John Hamm, showed the client during a 2013 episode of the AMC series. So the simplistic looking ads feature French fries, steak, or a cheeseburger below the line, past the Heinz, in the real life version breaking this week. The line is written past the Heinz in a slightly different font, while other elements are nearly identical. So the agency, they made light of this. Their creative director, Anselmo Ramos, he basically laughed it off like, oh, we were having a couple of old-fashioned cocktails with Don Draper and the rest of the crew from the agency, and we came up with this idea.
And sexually harassing our staff.
Yeah, slapping them on the ass. You know, just having some good Mad Men times.
Drinking a Bloody Mary at 8 a.m.
And came up with this as creative.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's a little cool from a homage perspective as a fan of the show. I think that's a high testament to the actual work that they did on the show.
Right.
Matthew Weiner and the rest of the writers on that show, I think, were always amazing. And that kind of drew me in as a creative. But it's also a little problematic as well that these guys are, you know, basically lifting creative. Like, you know, that's why you were hired. I'm sure Heinz as a brand could have watched Mad Men and not given you tons of billable hours to do that. They could have just done it themselves.
Right. I mean, you know, but I think that the sort of interesting distinction is are you... You're hiring somebody theoretically for a certain type of creative instinct that they possess, right? Like they have an ability to come up with something or an instinct to come up with something that, you know, like that's what creatives are compensated for. And I think that, and this is what we're kind of joking about in between the segment, is on one hand, it's an act of like supreme laziness. And on the other hand, it's an act of like a supreme creative chutzpah to be like, we're actually going to take this concept that is sitting in front of all of us. It's kind of like that, you know, there's a quote that I'm going to butcher, but like, you know, something like talent imitates, genius steals, or something to that effect. I think that's an Emerson quote. So, you know, I actually want to sort of praise them for the courage to take something that was on the ball, that was sitting there like that and running with it. I mean, and then on the other hand, I think that, you know, it also shows that in a certain way, you know, everything that we're doing is always, in some sense, mashup, homage, synthesis, and sort of putting things together. I think this works. The thing that I would warn about is I think now that you're going to get a lot of other people who don't have the initial creative spark hunting around Mad Men and other shows for other things that they can kind of, you know, pawn a new account off on mm-hmm. and come up with a new campaign with. And I doubt that that's really going to work in general. So I think, you know, the lesson from this is not the actual idea, but from reading culture in a really specific way that can work with your client. And in this case, obviously, it's directly there and set up for you. But in other cases, it's going to be a lot more subtle, and you're going to have to read a lot more sort of indirect signals for it. You know, and it's not just going to be laid out for you. But I think the next agency that tries to just say, but like, oh yeah, well, remember in season 3, they did that thing with, you know, Ford or whatever. I don't think that's going to work.
Yeah. I mean, there's only but so many times you can go to the well. And I guess I'm conflicted on a couple of things, because you're correct in the sense that everything is influenced and and taken from other things. Like, no, there is no idea of like the singular genius. Like, there's influence, and some of that influence, and from a cultural perspective, is archival. You know, right. The more you understand of a history of something, the deeper you can go on a topic, the more likely you are to pull influences and inspiration from them. And, you know, as you were talking, I was thinking about Lawrence Lessig's book, Remix.
Right.
You know, kind of talking about this idea of, you know, taking from different pieces of culture and putting them together right. to create something new. Hip hop is something born of that, obviously, with the use of sampling, you know, right. taking original compositions, changing them around to create something that is unique. But I think, and this is also a function of probably my time in hip hop, my age in hip hop, where like this idea of biting, like that was the worst thing you could do
right.
would be accused of biting somebody or not coming up with something original.
I feel that as a host. I see people trying to bite my style all the time.
Yeah, biting, but now biting is
fuck out of here.
Cool yeah. in a way. Like yeah. it's cool for you to like bite somebody's lyrics or bite somebody's style or bite somebody's beats or do something that's
thanks,
like
Jay-Z.
Not really that original, you know, and I think that's yeah. a little, you know,
but is that like the culture
it
that
raises an eyebrow.
Is that what transitioned? And I did make the little side eye at Jay-Z, but honestly there are some people that did start I would say, you know, in filmmaking, Quentin Tarantino is the sort of perfect example of this. He does shot for shot recreations of people that he likes and respects. And, you know, and Jay obviously directly quoted Biggie. Mm-hmm. So is that like sort of like the transition point when it became like, because I think what it is it's, they wouldn't call it biting, but it's almost like by mimicking you so well or doing something that is so precisely in your style, I'm showing you love or something.
Yeah, and Jay did, you know, reflect that where he was like, yo, I'm quoting him.
Yeah, yeah.
Which I think is like, and that's why I think like them giving the credit, like
yeah.
we didn't go into this later on in the article, but they do talk about how they're crediting them as copywriters.
Yeah.
In the campaign. And so it's not,
crediting the fictional firm.
Yeah, the
Sterling
fictional firm
Cooper
of Sterling Cooper
and Mad Men. They're
in
crediting
Mad Men,
yeah.
and actually they're also crediting Matthew Weiner as a copywriter, as the creator of the show. So it's
sort of a
double thing they're doing there with the fictional and the real.
Right.
But again, it's, you know, there's that, it's hard to really, I don't even think I'm doing a good job like personifying it, where it does sort of raise an eyebrow mm-hmm. at this idea that, oh, we could just take things from other people. And Quentin Tarantino is like you cited, he does do that. And I appreciate how he puts some stuff together, the martial arts, the spaghetti westerns. Yeah. He does all these different things.
Blaxploitation, yeah. Grindhouse, New Wave, I mean, yeah, everything.
He does a bunch
yeah,
of
yeah,
stuff.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know, he's problematic for a lot of other reasons.
Yeah, but I'm not saying without even opening yeah. all those other doors. I'm just talking about very precisely the transition point from, you know, and then in fact, when he first did it, like with Pulp Fiction, you know, the irony was that he did these homages, but he also did something at least in quote unquote, mainstream filmmaking at that time that had not been done, that mm-hmm. wasn't being done. So it was paradoxical because he was the ultimate biter, but then through doing that, put out a movie that in the mid 90s was not being put out by
yeah.
any other, you know, chain in the Hollywood system. So, you know, and just like this ad campaign. So maybe the real lesson is that this is brilliant, but it's most definitely a one-off.
Yeah. Like it makes me feel when you speak about one-off.
Yeah.
With when Oreo during the Super Bowl, when the lights went out in Atlanta and they had, like, they responded right away with this tweet or GIF. I can't remember quite what it was that just perfectly captured the moment of, like, oh, shit, there's a blackout at the Super Bowl and we have the copy and the right angle at it and right. boom.
Right.
And then everybody right. for a while was talking about how are we going to do like instant marketing? Like instant marketing is going to be the thing. And
right.
these things are like lightning in a bottle. Like to yep. your point, I don't know how useful it will be to go through like whether it's old Mad Men or any show that is steeped in these sort of, you know, metrics of creativity and see what you can pull out of them. Like, I don't know if you're going to be talking about the Carousel, which was like his famous ad for Kodak in the first right. season. Like, you know, I don't know how much you're going right. to get from that going right. forward.
No, I think that's what it is. So sometimes there are just one-offs and they can't be kind of replicated into a system. And that's, you know, always the tension of creativity in the private sector.
I mean, things like this, they sound good, but they put downward pressure also on the price of creative.
That's what's up. We got to get to what's next. All right, so now we got to get to what's next. And what's next really is a story and a theme that comes right to all of the issues that we talk about so much on this show, in our consulting, in our forecasting work, in our writing. And it's definitely about culture on the margins, letting culture simmer. But then when that culture does simmer and it does thrive at the margins and it grows and all of a sudden it's at the center, how does the quote unquote center culture respond to it? And there's this really interesting piece that was published in NPR Music by a fellow named Rodney Carmichael. He's a very interesting writer people should keep an eye on. We might have him on as well. And it's called Culture Wars. Trap music keeps Atlanta on hip-hop's cutting edge. Why can't the city embrace it? And you're going to be hearing in this segment, obviously, a little bit of Bad and Bougie, which is still the sort of trap obsession of the moment. And basically, Carmichael goes on to outline how, you know, trap music has obviously been, you know, this distinct Atlanta contribution to hip hop. It's been a sound and a style that has not only put Atlanta on the map, but really sort of influenced hip hop nationally and then by extension globally. It's led to the rise of Atlanta, Donald Glover's show, which, you know, we can't get enough of. And it is made sure that Atlanta, which is a city that honestly, to me, even with some of its kind of historical resonance, I mean, Atlanta's boring in a way. You know, I mean, Atlanta to me is like, it's, you know, it's CNN, it's Coca-Cola, it's, you know, it's not necessarily a cutting edge place. It's LA of the South. And I'm throwing a lot of barbs today.
You are.
But back on the end. Yeah. No, that's good. But that being said, there is no doubt with trap that it's doing something distinct for what that city is in terms of hip hop and pop culture. And what Carmichael is pointing out is that the city itself and the sort of civic institutions of the place have not wanted to associate themselves with trap. So we have the kind of classical paradox where, you know, a music that, again, definitely comes from the margins. It exemplifies, you know, I guess there is obviously, I mean, the name is trap music. So there's probably some, you know, there's obviously behaviors and activities or whatever that, you know, mainstream politicians or whoever are not going to want to condone or support. But at the same time, it also exemplifies problems in terms of race and class and inequality that most people that want to kind of booster a city don't want to talk about. And then at the same time, I could see, you know, in a couple of years, there'll be an overcorrection to this article when, you know, there become like bus tours like we have in New York to go for, you know, historical sites and hip hop. There'll be the same thing for historical sites and trap music. And then all of a sudden, you know, maybe by embracing it, the city will make it lame. But as it stands now, you have a form which is making Atlanta a center of a cultural map, which its sort of mainstream leadership does not want any part of. So we're back at that paradox.
Yeah, I really love this article because I think it captures a bunch of different things going on all at once. And I can understand where if you haven't spent a lot of time in Atlanta, it's easy to kind of have a push on Atlanta as being like boring. I actually don't think that at all. I think Atlanta,
it's not actually a boring city. It's a wild city.
No, I mean Atlanta, Atlanta is actually pretty wild. Like that's the thing about Atlanta. I think it has like a few really, if you just look at it from a global economic situation, it is the home of one of the more iconic brands in the world, which is Coca-Cola.
Mm-hmm.
You know, as a global brand, you'd be hard pressed to find one that doesn't have as that has more of a reaction than Coke, you know, or Coca-Cola, as they say, very specifically. It has, I think, still on record, maybe against O'Hare, but pretty much they go what and what, like the busiest airport in the country is Atlanta's airport. You know, it's routinely between Chicago's O'Hare and Atlanta's airport, as they do more traffic than JFK.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so Atlanta, I think, is a city of like these paradoxes. And that's where the conversation becomes really interesting, because you do have this kind of more traditional political old guard of the city, which is now, from the face of it, African-American, which was a transition that happened in the 60s that came out of the civil rights movement and all
more
that.
60s or 70s?
Well, out of the civil rights movement in the 60s, and then people started assuming leadership
in the 70s. So people like Andrew Young, John Lewis.
Right. But those guys, particularly like if you look at like the King family, even before Martin Luther King with his father, they had a very sort of middle class upbringing, as one could have in a segregated South.
Right.
And Atlanta does have like traditional institutions like a Spelman, like a Morehouse, but then that are historically black colleges.
Not as good as Howard. You know, got you back.
Not as good as
Howard.
Got you back. But I'm going to give love to that.
Yeah.
To that thing. But then they have on the flip a Georgia Tech, like a major, you know, technical engineering university.
And they got Emory.
They have Emory.
Like the top college.
Yeah, they have Emory. And even Georgia State.
And Georgia State.
Which might not have like sort of that sort of panache of those other schools I named. But
respectable,
it's a
state
big,
school.
Huge school, like in that SUNY and City College tradition for New York. So I backdrop all of that to say that I think what this article highlights from a culture perspective is that people have been drawn to Atlanta for years for a variety of different reasons, because it has this hub of education and business and music. You know, whether you go way back to like So Def, LaFace, Dungeon Family with Outkast, and pulling out all of this out of all of this. And the music, much like every place, is what makes everything kind of run, is what makes it cool, is what makes everybody go down there to grind. But yet, if they're branding the city, if they're trying to put this veneer on Atlanta, they miss an opportunity to embrace the music elements, because it is raw and
is that respectability politics?
I think to a certain extent there is a respectability politics to it, that to your points that the music is the base level of everything to me.
Right.
You know, like it doesn't require as much. So it's not even like film industry, you know? So Atlanta is
less complex.
Yeah, it's less complex. You don't need like studio and space and as much moving parts and permits. Like you can grind on music especially nowadays, like on your laptop.
Yeah.
You know, like you don't need that much.
Yep.
And I think that brings out that there's that yin and yang, where what's really making the city jump is the music, but those who are most in charge of branding the city are reluctant to use the music because the music has those rougher elements. And to a certain extent, if you want to bring in a multi-million dollar complex for film and what have you, like they've been very aggressive toward doing that, it's harder to make that argument if you're embracing any kind of music, particularly like trap music, if it's coming with the reputation toward drugs, violence, you know, all the usual.
I mean, yeah,
shit,
and it does not help what, you know, the literal name of the form.
Yeah,
you know, I mean, it's not like it's hidden.
No, it's pretty
right?
out
like
there.
It's called trap music, right? So, which, you know, is about, is it, for those who don't know, it's drug production, form of drug production. But look, but I also think that the other, I mean, maybe Atlanta as a show is the bridge, because that's so, you know, that's when you start to kind of balance out. That's so critically acclaimed while at the same time still being rooted in what we're talking about. Maybe that's the sort of vehicle where you start to get, you know, those conversations can start to cross-pollinate, because the people that feel cautious can say like, okay, first of all, I mean, Donald Glover, obviously, as just a dude, represents a very different energy, very different persona. And then the show, I mean, yeah, it's an unflinching show about, you know, the dynamics that maybe if you're just trying to put a smiley face on things, you don't want to represent. But it's a very, again, it's very smart. It's very critically acclaimed. It's very, it's just a very high quality and distinct product. So maybe that is the type of vehicle that you can start to kind of bridge those worlds a little bit. But what concerns me is, you know, I'm always looking for the overcorrection, because to me it's like, you know, the first step is okay, we don't really want to be associated with this thing, even though this is like what's kind of driving an energy here and making this place dynamic. And then all of a sudden, you know, the dumb PowerPoint gets made, and you know, there's some like dumb trap, you know, beat in some Come Visit Atlanta ad.
Yeah.
And then by the time we get to that point, it's not cool anymore. We're on to the next thing, and then you're just trying to cannibalize something because you haven't found that right cultural prime directive relationship with it.
And I think the trick to avoiding that, or the logic to which you avoid that, is to seek out those who are truly part
right.
of the culture, which means you have to take chances. Like if you're going to go out there and look for people who can speak to those things, you need to find those who are expert in it.
Right.
And those experts are, they might be people you know, they might be the names that you are familiar with, but you know, if you're going to really dive into that and do the kind of work we do, cultural anthropology work, is uncovering those people
right.
who can speak to these things in an authentic way. So when you do raise that ad of like a Welcome to Atlanta thing with like a whack ass beat or whatever, yeah. the people who are in charge that hopefully you would have trusted will be able to say like, this might not be the direction you want to go in. Like, this is going to come off kind of corny. Like, what are the ways to talk about like authentic Atlanta culture that will speak to these things in a real way? And I think like that's why the show Atlanta was so successful, because you see like the late night, you know, parking lot pimping, you see right. Waffle House, you see strip right. joints. Like, strip clubs are critical to Atlanta's music scene.
Right.
Like, that's how you break records. Like, if you are coming up in a game and you're trying to break a record, and many dudes have done this, like if you look up like Legion of Doom and other producers, they made their records and broke their records in strip clubs.
Right.
You know, if it's not popping in a strip club, it's not gonna be popping anywhere else.
Right.
You know, and so that was sort of like the place to test market your music. And Atlanta has one of the most vibrant strip club cultures in the world.
Right.
You know, like right. New York is terrible. You know, Vegas is corny. Like if you want that real experience, it's Atlanta.
Super producer Matt goes once a month.
There you go. Yeah. Atlanta, yeah. Houston, Memphis.
DC.
Nah.
Not DC?
Not DC.
All right. So they have an unearned reputation.
They have an unearned reputation.
All right. Fair.
You know, it's.
I defer to Phil on All Matters Strip Club.
There you go. I've done. I'm cultural yeah. anthropology, man. I go where the culture is, you know.
No, it's true. No, I mean, it's funny because it's really, and it's just really not the case in New York. There's nothing, you do not, and this is actually a really crucial distinction for people to understand. It's true if you're talking about a place like Atlanta. You do actually have to go there if you want to understand something.
Yeah.
In New York, you can go to Scores if you want to understand the mindset of somebody who thinks Donald Trump is cool. That's about it.
Yeah. They're corny up here.
Corny as fuck. All right. We got to get to the crates. Okay, so now we got to get to the crates. This is our culture pick, something that makes you faster, stronger, smarter, life more fun, gives you big comparative advantage, whatever. Phil, what do you have this week?
I got a bunch of British shows. You know, so Phil. Shout out to the Cadogan family, my British cousins. What's up, y'all? Y'all better be listening.
I'm sure they are.
I love British TV. I love British shows. And, you know, I get sucked into a bunch of them all the time. Like, I seek them out. And there's three in particular I'm going to name. One is older, so I'm going to start. And I just finished watching it, called Dead Set, which is actually a creation from Charlie Booker, of famous now for love Black Charlie Mirror. Booker, man. And it's and the other cool thing about British shows, they're short. Like, they're not like 22 fucking episodes, some bullshit. Like, you can literally binge watch multiple seasons, depending on the length of the individual shows, right, like in a day. And Dead Set's a really cool show. It's kind of a take on both reality show culture with Big Brother, and also zombie culture. Like, it combines those two things. It's pre-Walking Dead, and it's just very, very cool show, and it's short. Five episodes, one of which is 45 minutes. The rest are like 25 minutes. So super quick. And I loved it. I thought it was really well done. Another is a show called Chewing Gum, which is just hilarious in the sense of it was a show that's created by a Black woman comic. And, you know, I hate to like link people together. So it's not like she's doing an Issa Rae thing here, because that's too simple. But if you want to think about someone who's writing, producing, and creating their own vehicle through their own voice, that's where the similarities end. First season is available on Netflix. The second season is still running right now on BBC, so it's not available yet. And then the last show, which is really quick, it's called Catastrophe, which has two seasons available on streaming, though not on Netflix. And then the third season is currently running on BBC, and it's a show very simply about kind of international lovers. She's Irish, he's American. They end up trying to make a relationship work.
Yeah, yeah.
And now they're talking about like Brexit in the new season. So it's a really cool, funny, quick reality, not reality show, but relationship type show. And it's really funny. And the first two seasons are available streaming. And the third season is now currently running on BBC, I think BBC 4. So yeah. Shout out to all my British cousins and friends.
Always shout out to the McKenzie crew in the UK. All right, so I am playing the type this week, but I really would recommend that everybody read a book that came out in the mid-90s by a woman named Lori Gunst, and it's called Born for Dead. And it's her account of sort of Jamaican gang and posse culture. But this is the type of book that she situates this sort of gang warfare in Jamaica very much within the context of politics. These gangs and crews of gunmen grew out of the political warfare of Jamaica from basically like starting in the late 60s, but really reaching their peak in 1980, and all of the foreign influences that were on the island, you know, attempting to sort of exert pressure. IMF, United States, CIA, Cuban intelligence operatives, and that affected how they operated when they came to the 80s and 90s to the States in terms of the level of sophistication and violence that they operated with. But it's also an anthropological book and a really beautiful and tragic and really deeply disturbing story about really underclass in Jamaica. And it's one of these you know, what I like is that it's very specific and unique to a place and a culture and a set of problems and the sort of linkages between Jamaica and Brooklyn, as an example. And then there's other parts of the story that could be, you know, extracted to understand dynamics in Pakistan or Northern Ireland. And it's really well written, and it will give you a lot of context if you're interested in any number of things, from CIA to reggae to capitalism to
how drug markets work to the IMF, to austerity. So Born for Dead by Laurie Gunst, that's my pick for this week. I want to thank super producer Matt Leck. I want to thank creative director Shauna Wan. You can find us at Two Dope Boys Pod on Twitter, at Two Dope Boys Pod, at Two Dope Boys Pod on Instagram. Many things coming up.
Our anniversary, actually.
Our anniversary is coming up. Our got some things we're doing in May. We're going to be on the road a little bit. We'll keep you posted on all of that. We'll see you Thursday for On Point.